Stephen Beavers, could you do share time after the sermon? I forget to get somebody about once a week. We're in Exodus chapter 23. Be reading verses 20 through 33, finishing the chapter. Let's begin this morning by reading our text. Exodus chapter 23. Verses 20 through 33. Text says, "Behold, I sent an angel before you to keep you in the way and to bring you into the place which I have prepared. Beware of him and obey his voice. Do not provoke him, for he will not pardon your transgressions, for my name is in him. But if you indeed obey his voice and do all that I speak, then I will be an enemy to your enemies and an adversary to your adversaries. For my angel will go before you and bring you in to the Amorites and the Hittites and the Perizzites and the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Jebusites, and I will cut them off. You shall not bow down to their gods, nor serve them, nor do according to their works, but you shall utterly overthrow them and completely break down their sacred pillars. So you shall serve the Lord your God, and he will bless your bread and your water. And I will take sickness away from the midst of you. No one shall suffer miscarriage or be barren in your land. I will fulfill the number of your days. I will send my fear before you. I will cause confusion among all the people to whom you come, and will make all your enemies turn their backs to you. And I will send hornets before you, which shall drive out the Hivite and the Canaanite and the Hittite from before you. I will not drive them out from before you in 1 year, lest the land become desolate and the beasts of the field become too numerous for you. Little by little I will drive them out from before you until you have increased and you inherit the land. And I will set your bounds from the Red Sea to the sea, Philistia, and from the desert to the river, for I will deliver the inhabitants of the land into your hand, and you shall drive them out before you. You shall make no covenant with them, nor with their gods. They shall not dwell in your land, lest they make you sin against me. For if you serve their gods, it will surely be a snare to you." Let's sort of set context here. We know the children of Israel have come out of Egypt. It's been a matter of several weeks or perhaps several months. I'm not sure of the time span, but not that long, I don't think, that they have reached Mount Sinai. We went through the Ten Commandments, and then he gave us some case law and then some other instructions on different things. And now the Israelites are there in the wilderness, and God stops and tells them something about their future. Now, I suppose that they've been wondering about that. I would have been wondering, you know, how are we going to, where are we going? That'd be the first question. And how big is this place where we're going? And surely there are some people already there who are living there. Are they going to just let us waltz in there and be in their midst? Or, you know, what's going to happen? What's this going to look like? And here at an early stage, it seems like, of their journey across the wilderness, God tells them, perhaps not for the first time and not for the last time, about what we typically call the promised land. The promised land. Now, we're going to see as we go through the remainder of the book of Exodus several things that are in the Old Testament and in the book of Exodus that are pictures of things that we see in the New Testament, in particular, pictures of Christ and Jesus and His work for us. Now, that doesn't mean that everything that's there is some type of analogy or some type of picture. But the promised land is one that people tend to look at as if that it is. And perhaps it is. I'm not prepared to say yes or no. But it's interesting if you ask the question, okay, if the promised land is a type, what is it a type of? Some people say it's a type of heaven. Some people say, no, it's not a type of heaven, it's a type of salvation. Other people say it's a type of the victorious Christian life. And other people say it's a type of rest. Now, those last two, victorious Christian life and rest, are different, but they're very closely related. So which is it? You can look in, when I was growing up, you could look in our hymnal, and on one page, sing a song called On Jordan's Stormy Banks I Stand, Cast a Wistful Eye to Canaan's Fair and Happy Land, Where My Possessions Lie. Whoever wrote that song viewed Canaan, the Promised Land, as a type of heaven. You could turn over a few pages in our hymnal and sing a song that goes like this. I'm not going to sing it, but I'm living in Canaan now. Right? And that person, I think, viewed the Promised Land as a type of salvation, of being delivered from their sins. I'm not sure which way it is. I would tend to lean toward the idea of rest or the victorious Christian life, but I'm sure there are some of you who would have different ideas about that, and that's neither here nor there. But here God is telling these people, His people, here's what you've got to look forward to. Here's what's coming up. Now suppose, we just read it, you saw what it said. Suppose you were at that meeting. Suppose you heard what God had said, and He said it through Moses. You remember the children of Israel don't want God to speak to them directly anymore. They want to go through Moses. So Moses tells them, here's what God said. You're there and you go home and your spouse or your neighbor wasn't there and they ask you, what did God say? Well, He told us about the place that we're going to go, the place that we're headed for. He told us all about that. Well, what did He say? Here's what you would have summarized this in this way. You see, I've got number one there. He told us that an angel from God will lead us. Now, is that good news? It is. I would think so. All right, this angel is going to go before us and lead us and keep us in the way and lead us to where we're going. Okay, that's good. We're glad for that. In fact, that probably, and we'll talk about this in a minute, they probably already familiar with this idea a little bit. Well, what else did He say? He's going to drive all our enemies out of the land, and we will possess the land. That sounds good. He's going to keep our bodies healthy, keep us from getting sick. Our wives will not have miscarriages. We will not be barren. We shall be fruitful. We'll live to a ripe old age. He'll give us long lives. And you should hear how much land He's giving us. From the Nile River through the Mediterranean Sea on our west, across the Jordan on our east, all the way up to the Euphrates River. Now it's probable that a lot of those people didn't have a clue how much land that was. But I'm sure word got around. This is a pretty big piece of property. This is a lot of land for us. Plenty of room. Is that all He said? That's what you would have heard. And that's what would have stuck in your mind, that good stuff. But there's some fine print, wasn't there? The fine print. So all we have to do is follow Him and do what He asks. No problem. piece of cake. Who wouldn't follow him with those kind of promises? Surely, this is going to be work out all right. Let's look at specifically what he says in this text. First thing I want to deal with is this angel. Who is this angel? I'm going to read a few verses. If you can find them fast enough, and you may can find them quicker than I can, you can read them with me. The first one is in Exodus chapter 3, verses 2 to 6. Like I said, I think the people probably have some idea about this angel who's going to go before them. Exodus chapter 3, verses 2 to 6, notice what it says. And the angel of the Lord appeared to him as Moses, appeared to him in a flame of fire from the midst of the bush. So he looked, and behold, the bush was burning with fire, but the bush was not consumed. And Moses said, I will now turn aside and see this great sight, why the bush does not burn. When the Lord saw that he turned aside to look, God called to him from the midst of the bush and said, Moses, Moses. And he said, Here I am. He said, Do not draw near this place. Take off your sandals, off your feet, for the place where you stand is holy ground. Moreover, he said, I am the God of your father, the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, the God of Jacob. And Moses hid his face, for he was afraid to look upon God. Here we know the account. We've looked at this when we were in the earlier chapters of Exodus. And it says that there's a burning bush, and the angel of the Lord appears to Moses in this burning bush and talks to him from the burning bush and talks to him, recording as he is, this is God speaking to you. So there's one indication of how this phrase, the angel of the Lord, is used. We look over in Exodus chapter 13. The children of Israel have come out of Egypt, and they are on the banks of the Red Sea, fixing to cross over it, and they're stopped there. And in Exodus chapter 13, verses 21 and 22, it says, And the Lord went before them in a pillar of cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. So here's this, I don't know how you always have pictured this, you know, throughout your life as you heard this story, but a pillar of cloud during the day, and God is placing that there. This says the Lord went before them in this pillar of cloud. And at night it's a pillar of fire. It's there. It goes before them, leading them. All right, you look on over in chapters 14, verses 19 and 20. And the angel of God, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud and darkness to the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. So you have this cloud that's separating the Egyptian army from the Israelites. It does so in such a way that they are kept apart. The Egyptians cannot come to them and finish trying to capture them and carry them back to Egypt. But this pillar cloud is just there. If you look on over in verse 24, it says, And it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked down upon the army of the Egyptians through the pillar of fire and cloud, and he troubled the army of the Egyptians. Now you go on past where we're at this morning to chapter 32. And verse 34, this is Moses talking to the Lord. We're going back to verse 33. The Lord said to Moses, Whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Now therefore, go lead the people to the place of which I have spoken to you. Behold, my angel shall go before you. Nevertheless, in the day when I visit for punishment, I will visit punishment upon them for their sin. So here you see, again, God speaking about this pillar going to lead them. Chapter 33, in verse 2, God says, "I will send my angel before you." This is very close to saying the same thing of what we're reading in our text this morning. "Send my angel before you, and I will drive out the Canaanite and the Amorite and the Hittite and the Perizzite and the Hivite and the Jebusite." And then in verse 14, he says, "My presence will go with you, and I will give you rest." So the Israelites, if they're not already familiar with this idea of the angel of the Lord going before them and leading them with this pillar of cloud or of fire, they're already familiar with that. And this is not the end of the story. They're going to continue to have interaction with this pillar of cloud. So, is this the same thing? I think I would have to say almost obviously, yes, it is. But there is something different in our text that we don't see in those other ones. This angel has a personality. Now, perhaps he did in the others, but it just, the pillar of cloud separating them from the Red Sea just seemed like to me an object. It was just there. But the angel that we're looking at today is something different. What does he say about him? He says, he will keep you. He will bring you. Okay, if you will obey his voice, he says, beware of him. He's talking about this pillar, this angel, not as an inanimate object, a pillar of cloud, but as a person. Beware of him. Obey his voice. Do not provoke him. He will not pardon your transgressions. So there are phrases that are incorporated in our text this morning that we don't see in these other instances. And it gives the idea that this pillar of a cloud, or this angel of the Lord that he calls him here, he doesn't call him a pillar, is a person. And that person, I would tend to believe, is the presence of God. In some way, God's angel is at one, at least with God. He says in the end of verse 24, "My name is in him." So that's this angel of the Lord. I would think that the children of Israel still are happy that this presence of God will lead them. This presence of God is going to keep them. This presence of God is going to give them all of these things that has promised them that he will do, in driving their enemies out, protecting their own physical bodies, etc. So, number three, what has God said that he will do for them? What is it that God is going to do? There are a number of phrases in our text where you see these, starts out with these words, "I will." God says, "I will." Let's look at all the things that God says he will do. The first one is not an "I will," it's an "I send." "I send this angel before you." He says, "I will be an enemy," in verse 22. "I will be an enemy to your enemies." It's good to know that the people who are my enemies are God's enemies too. The people who are my adversaries are God's adversaries too. It's good to be on the same side with God, if that's not speaking lightly of God. What else does he say? When you get there, there are all these nations, the Amorites, the Hittites, so forth. God says, here's another "I will." "I will cut them off. God is showing partiality to his people over these other people. Now, we might could find a legitimate reason to do so, but there's no need looking. If he does it, he does it. I will cut them off, he says. Verse 25, what does he say? I will bless your bread and your water. Some of the most simplest and most basic needs that we have, food and water, God says, when you get there, I will bless it. The most simplest basic things that you have will be blessed by me. He goes on, he says, I will take sickness away from the midst of you. I will keep you from getting sick. No one shall suffer miscarriage. When your wife becomes pregnant, I will keep her from miscarrying the child. There no one will be barren, and I take that to mean barren as far as being able to have children. It could be talking about barren, the land being barren and not growing crops, but it seems to be in the idea of having children. And I will fulfill the number of your days. In other words, you're going to get your 40 or your 70 or whatever it has used in the scripture. Some of you already got your 70.
And then some.
Right? Because I'm going to give you a long life. I'm going to keep you from getting sick. I will give you a long life. Verse 27, he says, I will send my fear before you. You're going into the land, and prior to you getting there, the people who are there, who are your enemies, who are your adversaries, are going to be fearful of you before you get there. Did that happen? It did. I will send my fear before you. And these people are going to be afraid of you. And notice, I like this phrase at the end of verse 27. They'll turn their backs to you. Why would they turn their backs to you? Because they're running. All right? They have lit a shuck, and they're out of there, and all you can see is they're back in. They're leaving. Verse 28, I will send hornets before you, which shall drive them out. I don't have a problem with taking this literally. I'll send hornets. God wants to send hornets to drive out the Canaanites and the Hivites and the Hittites. They're perfectly fine with me. Whatever he wants to do. But he uses different methods and different means, but he's driving the people out. Verse 29. I like these verses. Verse 29, he says, I will not drive them out all at once or in one year. Now, why would that be? He kind of tells us why he will not do it that way. Because this is a big land. You're not going to go in and repossess it or possess it in 2 weeks. It's going to take some time to settle out and to spread out and establish yourself. And I'm only going to drive them out as needed. What's the advantage of that? Well, he says, so the place won't grow up. Does your place grow up if you don't take care of it? Or ours does. You can plant a garden and 3 weeks later the weeds are this tall and what I want to grow is this tall. All right? It grows up. So what is God doing? He's letting the inhabitants of the land, he's letting their adversaries keep the place up until they want it, until they need it. I like that. All right? When they get there, the yard's going to be mowed, the crops are going to be plowed, it's going to be ready to go. And God, at the last minute, drives them out, and here it is. Says, I will set your bounds. Tells them where their boundaries are going to be, that they will inhabit the land. It's a pretty nice piece of property. Miles and miles of acres. That's what God says. Here's what I'm going to do. Here's what I'm going to do for you. And that's what they heard. Now, they heard this other stuff. This is the next point on the next page. Wasn't there a few things he wanted us to do as well? They heard this stuff, but I'm not sure that it really sunk in. The first thing God told them to do is to beware of this angel. Don't look at this angel who's leading you lightly. Don't take him lightly. When he tells you to do something, do it. Because he is speaking for me. It is me you're hearing. Obey his voice. Don't provoke this angel. How would they provoke this angel? I'm not sure. I know how I provoked my father. Generally just disobeying in any way was enough to get his attention. And then promptly he got my attention. Don't provoke this angel. Don't do that. Beware of him. Do what he says. Don't provoke him. What else did he tell them? Do not worship the gods, these false gods and these idols that are in the land when you get there. I'm driving them all out. Don't intermingle yourself with these people's worship. Don't serve their gods. Don't worship their gods. You can see that in verse 24. Don't bow down to their gods. Don't serve their gods. Don't do according to their works. Don't act like these people that we're fixing to drive out. And when you get them out, completely dismantle and destroy anything and everything that had to do with their worship. Get rid of it. Now, sitting at Mount Sinai, seeing what God has done, hearing what God has promised to do, I don't think I would feel like I'd have a problem with doing that. I can do that. There's no problem. That's what I would have wanted to have done to begin with, right? You are to serve the Lord your God. Verse 25, okay, that's no problem. We can do that. You're to drive out your enemies. He repeats that in verse 31. You're to make no covenants with them nor with their gods. Don't interact with these people in anything that ties you together, whether it's a business relationship or whatever. Don't mingle yourselves and bind yourselves with these people. You're to be completely separate from them. Steer clear of them. Doesn't sound too bad. Doesn't sound like something I can't do. And I don't want to jump into John's text for next week, but two times you're going to see in his text, the children of Israel hear these things from God, and they say, all the words that you've spoken, we will do. We'll do it. I'm no prophet. You don't have to be a prophet to look behind you. But if I had been there, if we had been there that day, knowing what we know now, and we heard them say, we will do it. What you have spoken, we will do. I would have wanted to say, no, you won't. You won't do it. You will not do it. This reminded me of something I heard 25 or 30 years ago, and I want to share with you. I would imagine probably half of you or maybe all of you have heard of this. Eight cycles of a civilization. If you haven't heard of these, write these down and just think about them. First one is this: bondage. Bondage. A people are in bondage. For instance, the Israelites in Egypt, were in bondage. The second cycle, or step in this part of this cycle, is spiritual faith. People have a strong faith for whatever reason, God working on their life and in their hearts, and they have a strong spiritual awakening, even in their bondage. And that leads to the third one. And the third one is courage. This strong experience of spiritual faith emboldens them. It gives them courage to act. And then the fourth one, they go from courage to liberty or to freedom. From freedom, they go to abundance. God blesses them. They have abundance. From abundance, they go to complacency. We've got enough. What could possibly go wrong? Everything's going fine. Let's sit down and rest. We buy ourselves a recliner, and we take it easy. From complacency, they go to apathy. We don't care. My life is okay, it's not too bad, so what if my neighbor's hurting? Okay, that's his business. I've got my own problems, although they're not very bad. We don't care. From apathy goes to dependence. Because at some point, this kind of behavior catches up to you. At some point, in some way, you develop a dependence on somebody else, usually the government, to meet your needs. And from dependence, you're back to bondage. Now, that's not original with me. I don't know who. I think it was a guy named Titler, T-I-T-L-E-R, that I saw was given credit for putting that together. I don't know. I'm not saying it's always accurate. But it gets my attention. It does. I want you to think of that along the lines of the children of Israel. They're sitting at Mount Sinai saying, we'll do whatever God says for us to do. They've been delivered from bondage from God. They believe God. They believe that God can do great things. They have seen Him do great things. And they're going to exhibit tremendous courage. Now, I know all this stuff kind of fluctuates back and forth, and there's a lot of second guessing at times, but there are times when they exhibit great courage going across the wilderness and taking the promised land. And they are free. And God tells them, I'm going to bless your land. And they have abundance. But what happens? We're looking ahead in the story several hundred years. By the time David is king, their second king, by the time David is king, the nation of Israel is pretty much at its peak. It's a downhill ride from there on, isn't it? I'm not sure of the year that we're looking at right here, 1200 to 1500 BC or somewhere in that range. By the time they get to 800 BC, 10 of the tribes, up to the 12 tribes, are gone. They're taken into captivity by the Assyrians, I believe. 150 or so years later, the other two are gone. They have gone from Egypt in bondage to Babylon and Persia in bondage. The cycle has made its way through. They have reached points where they cared not for God, for the things of God. There were little periods of short revivals of certain kings turned their heart back to God and got rid of all the idols and got rid of all these things, but they were short-lived. That's Israel. It's hard to look at that cycle and not think of our own country, isn't it? You see, bondage, I'm not sure the degree of bondage that our forefathers, founding fathers were in at the time of the Revolutionary War. If they considered that bondage, I'm not sure what they would consider what we have to put up with. But there it is. Great spiritual faith followed, courage followed, and liberty followed. And then for the next 100, 150 years, God seemed to bless this nation. It became the greatest nation on the face of the earth. Abundance, a rich, a wealthy people. A place where everyone in the world wanted to go. But what happened? Several things happened. I'm fairly young guy, not 62. I used to think 62 was old folks. Now I know it is. But looking back in my life, if I were going to place where we are at on this scale, from my perspective, I would think that 50 years ago, the church in America was complacent. We had abundance, but the church was complacent. My perspective of the church, the Christian church, 50 years ago, was that almost everybody went to church. I was in grade school, public school, grade school. Almost every kid's family went to church on Sunday. But that doesn't mean they were serious Christians. They went to church. And their kids, who would be my generation, quit going to church. There was a time, and I may have shared this with you, but there was a time 20 years ago that I thought back through and I made a list. Susan and I grew up in church together, so we were teenagers together in church. I made a list of all the kids that I went to church with. From they were about 12 years old to 18 years old. All the kids that I went to church with, I had 40 kids. I remember the numbers. I had 40 kids on my list. At the time that I made my list, five of them were still doing what their parents did, just going to church. 35 were out. I don't know what it's like today. I haven't went back through that list. But of those five, there was probably two or three that were serious about their walk with God. What happened? It's a complacency. It's an apathy that who cares? My life's good. I've got a good job. And it reveals something about your faith. It may reveal that you really don't know God. How have things changed? For one thing, not everybody goes to church nowadays. And church is not the answer, I know that. But not everyone goes. Most people don't. And they've got a very good reason not to go, because it's a bunch of hogwash. They've seen the complacency. They've seen the apathy. They've seen the unseriousness with which the church looks at their faith. And it means nothing to them, because they see it is nothing. And what we will see, is a generation of people, for the last couple of generations, where people are giving their freedoms up for someone else, if someone else will take care of them. You meet my needs, you send me a check, and I'll be your slave. They don't say that, do they? But that's, in reality, that's what's happening. And the things that will happen, the things that people will do in order to keep that dependent state that they're in, they care nothing for freedom. They care nothing for liberty. And someday, we may wake up and find ourselves in bondage. Perhaps not. What about just a personal look? Can this cycle fit you just as an individual? I think so. You can look through this and think of your own personal life and see if you have walked through any of these steps. So, the Israelites are there. They hear all these things. God told them, here's what I'll do for you. And all you got to do is these things. And they said, we'll do it. Is that what you would have said if you had been there? I think so. I think I would have. Why? Why would I have said that? Because I look at the promises that God's given, and I have this, when the decisions are to be made a year from now, they don't seem quite as tough right now. Kind of like dieting. I feel like dieting is so easy right after I eat a big hamburger. All right, that wouldn't be, I couldn't go without the next 2 days without eating, no sweat. Well, my stomach starts growling a little bit about 4 or 6 hours later. It's not quite so easy, is it? It's that way with a lot of other things. I can look at this and say, I can obey God. I can do this. We can do it. We can drive them out. We can serve God until the temptation is this close. And then we'll start tomorrow. Then suddenly it's not quite so easy. Why would we say we can do it? Because we overestimate our own abilities. We underestimate the pull of our flesh to do wrong, to do evil. We should do it. Why should we do it? Primarily because it is right. When God says, do this, if there's no other reason to do it, and there doesn't have to be one, God says, do this, we should do it for no other reason than because He said to, because it is right. But there are benefits to obeying God, isn't there? If I were to ask you, in fact, I want to ask you, if you could name one thing that living an obedient and walking in a walk of obedience to God, if you could name one thing that living in obedience to God would result in, what would you say? Salvation that's available?
You know it's coming.
Okay. If you could name one thing that walking a life of obedience with God would result in, what would you name?
Joy,
peace, blessings. Are those things real? They are. I notice none of you named a 10,000 square foot house. None of you named $1 billion. None of you named a Learjet. Okay? There are things that are results and fruit of walking with God that's different than those things. In fact, those are not even, won't even be there. But no matter what else happens, and I'm not saying that your life is going to be all a bed of roses. I'm not saying your life won't be rife with trials and heartaches. But the one thing or two, couple of things that can be there in walking with God is one, joy. There are no amounts of sorrow that can take away real joy. Another thing is peace. There are no trials so hard, so difficult, that it can rob you of peace with God. Those are real things. Real things that you can reap from walking with God. The children of Israel, some of those people will experience those things, won't they? They will. They will experience, just like some of us, hopefully most of us, will have experienced and will experience a long and a lasting peace and joy. But they've got a long road to hoe to get there, don't they? They're not there yet. But God has given them a picture. God has given them a view ahead. Here's what is yours. Let's pray.